So I'm going to talk about a work which some of which has been recently published in Physical Review Letters, and I xeroxed a few papers here, and you can xerox more, which means that for those of you that are really interested, you can just take the paper and go to the coffee room and enjoy it. It is a work which I think has potential interest to both, I don't know if there are any biologists here, I mean experimentalists, I mean, we are all biologists, and then theorists, and I think in general statistical mechanics, information, classical and quantum, potentially interest to them, I think, as well. But let me then start off with it's a PowerPoint presentation, although it could be just a blackboard also, but I'm lazy now to change it. So let's just do it like this. Okay, so this work has been done in collaboration with Cook Jin Kang. He was a postdoc at Hebrew University for 2 years, and now he's at NYU and Courant. And I'll show some demonstration of how you apply it to experimental data. Not really, we don't have any conclusions really about data, but just to show that it can be applied to analyze data, and the data is about monkey motor cortex recordings from the laboratory of Moshe Abeles by Yoram Ben Shaul and from the lab of Elon Vadia. But again, this will be very thin on the experimental part. And the actual topic has to do with population coding and how they are related to the question of distance in probability space. So the question is, if you have space of probabilities over some events, and what is the relevant or the interesting measure of distance or dissimilarity between two probabilities? And you'll see it in a moment. Okay, so I forgot her name.
Julia Roberts.
What? Oh, Julia something, right?
Julia Roberts.
Oh, Julia Roberts, okay. I don't know why Cook Jin decided to put her picture, but in general, the idea is that you have two stimuli and two faces or two objects, and there is an observer, an animal, a human. There are neurons which respond in some fashion to two stimuli. I don't know the stimuli, but theta. So theta 1 is one stimulus, theta 2 is another stimulus. And the neurons code in some way the different stimuli, but they find pattern. So you have a neural code of the external events or the external world. I'll use R for denoting the response of a neuron.
So
lowercase. What?
Is that an awake monkey?
This one. This one. But anyway, I think it's awake, Julia. But so a single neuron respond will be lowercase R or RI. But anyway, so you have a single neuron responding to the stimuli. When I say responding, I actually mean that they emit a several number of spikes in time, which is loosely related to the onset of the stimulus. And you measure, I mean, so the question is how to measure the response. And in all what I'll say, the response will just be a scalar variable, integer or continuous, which is, if it's integer, is simply the number of spikes emitted within some certain fixed time window t that of the measurement of following the onset of the stimulus. So that's what we will denote as the response R of the neuron, the response R for following the presentation of stimulus theta 1, and the same neuron will emit different number of spikes for another stimulus. And another assumption is that this responses are stochastic. This is the whole notion of population coding, is coming from the observation that very often when you repeat the same stimulus several times, you see that neuron responds at least in terms of the number of spikes in a given window, change, vary. And the naive assumption would be that this variation is stochastic, it's due to some noise. I mean, of course, you can argue that this is not the case, that there are some aspects of the world or the internal state of the brain which is which are coded in these variations. But I'll take the simplistic view that given the presentation of a set of stimuli, each stimulus generates a stochastic response. And therefore, it's non-trivial to actually discriminate between two different stimuli on the basis of observing the activity of a neuron at a certain window of time. Okay, so the way to look at it, one way to look at it is to think in terms of probabilities or conditional probabilities. So you say a given stimulus, theta 1, is associated with a probability distribution of the number of the value of R, the response of a neuron, and another stimulus is associated with another distribution. And of course, there is some overlap between the distribution. Therefore, there is some ambiguity. If you have a single response, single event, there is some ambiguity about which stimulus generated this event. So that's the concept of distribution, which are associated with stimuli. So essentially, all that we talk about, feature selectivity and tuning of neurons in the brain to various aspects of the external world, or to some motor behavior, motor action, all these essentially are embedded in the form of P. In other words, if P of R is a sharp function of theta, as we'll see later on, then the neuron has a sharp tuning. If it is sort of independent or very weakly dependent on theta, so these distributions are largely overlapping, then the neuron is weakly tuned or badly tuned for this stimulus, for this set of stimuli.
R is stepping for what?
So R can stand for if it's a number of spike, in that case it will just vary over the integers, unlike what I drew here. If you think in terms of, let's say, interspike interval, for the first interspike interval, then it could be just real valued. I'm drawing it as a continuous, but it doesn't have to be. I mean, in most applications that we use, okay, most people use two standard models. One is Gaussian, in which case R is real. And it's valid if the typical values of R are not too small. Then you can sort of think about it as a real number, or Poisson, which is more appropriate for real number of spike. But the theory is quite general about independent of the real nature of R, whether it's integer or real. The general concept are independent of that. There is more, and what I'll focus on rather is whether the space of thetas, the set of stimuli, are discrete or continuous. That's essentially the core of my talk. But whether R is integers or continuous, it doesn't matter so much. And as we'll see later on, R is actually multidimensional because you have many neurons. This is for a single neuron, single variable, scalar variable.
Yeah, but it's the average rate,
The average rate would be average over this probability. R is the number of spikes emitted. Think about it, the number of spikes emitted within, let's say, 200 milliseconds after the onset of a stimulus for a given try, a given presentation of a stimulus. And it's a stochastic variable because when I repeat the same stimulus twice, I'll get different R. The average, the mean rate for this stimulus will be the average with respect to this distribution. And the mean rate emitted for this stimulus will be the average with respect to this distribution. Then you can take about variance and so on. So in general, we have a whole probability of emitting R number of spikes for a given stimulus. Okay. So how do we measure the accuracy of coding? How good is this coding of stimuli, set of stimuli? And there have been several suggestions in the literature, several methods that have been used. Two of them I mentioned here. One of them is mutual information, so it is inspired by information theory. How many bits of information is added by observing the response, and I'll define it later on more precisely. And the other one is more statistical inference or statistical estimation theory, which is maximum likelihood discriminated, an example. So you ask, given some task for discriminating different stimuli on the basis of an observation of the response of the neuron, what will be the average error of such a maximum likelihood ideal or an ideal discriminator, if ideal or just a maximum likelihood discriminator. I'll define it more precisely soon. So one of the problem, again, assuming this is an informal talk, one of the problem in this area is that you can have more than one or two measures of accuracy of coding, and it's largely dependent on what you assume about the actually hidden agenda of the system. You have a neural ensemble of code different stimuli. If you think that they are specially designed for a given task, you should use this specific task and ask and use this as a reference for measuring how good this neuron are doing the job or supposed to do the job. But in general, if you talk about primary motor areas or primary sensory areas, or even if you talk about face areas, it's not clear to us what the system is sort of designed or evolved to primarily. There you can think about identification, discrimination, learning, so many things, and so on. So we are looking for some general purpose kind of measures, and so this is of course some very general, just how much information is stored. And this is slightly more specific, talks about discrimination between the stimuli, so it's slightly more specific, sort of have some discrimination task in mind. Now the hope is, so if the results about the measure of accuracy of different measures or proposals here in the list will give different, very different answers to how the system is performing, then one should sort of think more deeply about this. Now the hope, certainly as physicists, we hope that there is some universal behavior which is sort of independent of what is a specific measure that you use. And that's the thing which I'll aim to. I'll aim at finding a framework or showing to you that in some limits, if you do mutual information test or you measure the accuracy of coding by maximum likelihood discriminator and related measures, they all rely on one basic property of the probability space that this system has. And this is the good, I think, a very, very, very nice result, because then you can sort of stop arguing about, is this discrimination task that the system is designed to, or this is identification, and so on. In some limit, all of this will give the same answer, or very similar answer. So that's the goal of this theory. Okay, so let's go to the mutual information. So mutual information, it can be defined as the entropy of the stimulus, simply summing of all the stimulus with some prior probability of the stimulus p of theta and log p of theta, the usual entropy, and this assumes that there is some frequency of appearance of the stimuli themselves. They can be uniform, but maybe the nature, the natural environment. You know, maybe Julia Roberts appears more frequently than the chimpanzee, and so on. So this is the property of the set of stimuli that the system is presented with, or the animal is presented with. So this is the total entropy of the stimulus, and this is the entropy of the stimulus conditioned on the observation R. So given that I observe a certain response R, capital R is denoting because there are maybe many neurons, but I'll come to it. But given that I observe a response R, it limits to some extent the possible sources that generated it. So the entropy now is reduced, the entropy of the stimuli conditioned on the response R. So the difference between them is the mutual information. You can also, it's an elementary pop result that you can also write I as the entropy of the response, the ensemble of responses, minus the entropy of the responses conditioned on the stimulus. which is in some sense maybe more an easier way of writing it down is, or thinking about mutual information. There is all possible responses, so the entropy of all possible responses, and then for a given stimulus, there is some probability of responses, which is gives you a smaller possibilities or a sharper distribution of responses for given stimulus. So it reduces the entropy of the responses, and the difference between the total entropy of the responses and the responses generated by given stimulus, average of all stimuli, is the mutual information. Okay, this is classical result. These two expressions are identical. Okay, and David, you should write it down because. No, it's important. I mean, it's very elementary, but it's important to know that you can think about it in two ways. Okay. Anyway, so the formal definitions are here for this one: the entropy of theta and the entropy of theta given R, and you average over all theta. Okay. And the P of theta given R is the Bayes theorem is given here. It's very simple. Okay. So everything is defined here. That's fine.
Yeah, that's one simple way. You said this is a general measure because it gives you bits and doesn't commit yourself to the time. Yeah. But this is only general to consider all possible inputs, all possible stimuli. The moment you restrict yourself to some set of stimuli, it's not general.
No. All these are general given. Yeah, it's general only in the sense, I mean, all the things that you can do, I think, you have to restrict yourself to a set of stimuli. In that sense, all the measures that I used, that I'm going to talk, have some set of stimuli in mind, in some sense. Yeah, but otherwise, but if you don't have a notion of what is a set of stimuli, then there is no point of looking at the responses, because maybe this system is actually, you know, designed to respond to something which you didn't have actually.
What? People are thinking of other ways.
Which is what?
Without deciding for themselves what is to do.
Yeah.
If you are looking at the monkey, just you can let the monkey go in the woods,
yes,
and they decide what stimuli are.
No, that's fine. That's the way of deciding which stimuli are. I mean, that's the same. You can do it either in the lab, choosing for the monkey, or you can have some theory about natural stimuli. I mean, that's a different question. I mean, but you have to assume something about the stimuli. I didn't say that the good assumption is by putting in the lab some artificial things. Maybe it's a bad assumption. But after you take the monkey to the woods, you collect, or the monkey collects what is the natural stimuli, then you go back and you make this quantities. Okay. I mean, it's an important question, of course. What is, whether giving a set of artificial stimuli in the lab, everything is mathematically well defined, but whether it's interesting in terms of the system, I agree. It's okay. Okay, so this is maximum likelihood. Just measuring this difference in entropy, the extra gain, the number of bits of the extra information you gain, or the amount of uncertainty that you reduce by the observing the responses. Okay, the maximum likelihood discriminator is. Is doing the following thing. You assume you have, for simplicity, you have two stimuli, theta 1, theta 2. You are given a response R, and you have to decide whether it's generated by theta 1 or theta 2. And maximum likelihood will say that everything which is to the right here, if R comes here, then it's generated by theta 2. If R comes here, generated by theta 1. Simply takes the log likelihood or the ratio between this and decide about the maximum value of that. I'm assuming there is no bias. So obviously there is some error here or confusion. This area will give you some probability of confusion, because here it can, if you generate a theta 1, you will say theta 2, but it actually there is some probability it came from theta 1. So the areas of overlap define the probability of confusion. This will be the probability of confusion in state at theta 1, and this will be the probability of confusion coming from theta 2, and this sort of is a measure of the performance or the error of the maximum likelihood discriminator. Okay, and you can generalize it for many stimuli. So that's maximum likelihood discriminator, that mutual information, you can extend it to multiple neurons, and that's actually what is what our the interest to us is. The you take the issues, put them together. I'm assuming sort of independent neurons. I'll define it soon, and then you have probabilities on higher dimension, like p of r1 r2 given one stimulus, or p of r1 r2 given two stimuli. And again, you have some overlap, and you can calculate these things. Okay, and in general, what I'll talk is about where R is high dimension. So you think about probabilities defined in n-dimensional space where n is large. Okay, so the question is one important question to ask would be how the quality of the neural code depend on the size of the ensemble of the neuron. So the size is this R1, R2, or the number of neurons that you look at. In order to make a decision about what stimulus generated it. And also about, in general, about the tuning properties of the P of R and so on.
You mean the size, you mean the number R is like the number of spikes you have. So
No. R1, here is two, right? Okay. Here is one, you have one neuron. You look at one neuron, here you look at two neurons simultaneously. So I'll introduce N, will be the number of the ensemble of neurons that you measure. Okay, so here you're looking at two neurons simultaneously. You measure R1, R2, and you again have to decide whether this is coming from this one or this one. So in this case, you know, the size of the ensemble is two. Okay, in general, you look at 50 or 100 or 1,000 neurons simultaneously. You have a vector of R's, R1, R2, R2, Rn. And you have to decide, is this vector of responses generated by this stimulus or that stimulus and so on? Okay? So they have to be, of course, simultaneously recorded or simultaneously observed by the homunculus in the brain and to make a decision.
And you're also removing like a common part, a correlated part?
Well, I so far I didn't say anything about correlations, but I'll assume that it's statistically independent. I'll come to that. But in general, they may be correlated. Okay, second question is, what are the property of mutual information and the maximum likelihood discriminator? And the last one is there any more basic concept which characterize the probability space which sort of determines these properties, mutual information, maximum likelihood discriminator? Okay, because it's obvious intuitively that you look at two distributions like that, okay, and it's obvious that if they are well separated, then you are in good shape, then the discrimination error will be small, mutual information will be large, and so on. But the question is how you determine, how you define, or how you characterize overlapping distributions. You can, you know, they have complicated shapes, they're high dimensional. What is a good measure of whether probabilities are, you know, the closeness or the similarity or the distance between probabilities? And when I say good measure, I mean a measure which is relevant to the quantities which I define. Okay. Proper measure of distance in probability space. Okay, that's the question. Okay, so I'm going to assume now that there are many neurons and they are statistically independent. So that's now the basic assumption for this talk. We have a whole series of work about the effect of correlation, but that's another talk, and which I'm not giving this week. Don't worry. So I won't talk about it today. So this is for statistically independent neurons. Now, when I say statistically independent, there is, of course, signal correlation in the language of biologists, which is a weird notation, but anyway, which means that of course these neurons are co-vary. When you put this one stimulus, two neurons will respond to it. You put another stimulus, two neurons will be inhibited, and so on. I don't mean that they don't act in terms of their mean responses together, but what I mean is that the fluctuations, you know, given for a given stimulus, the fluctuations, the statistical fluctuations of different neurons are uncorrelated.
You also assume that they have the same distribution.
No. I'm sorry. No. This is just a bad notation. This should be PI and so on. In general, they're not. They're not identical.
Okay, so that's
right. No, you're right. I mean, that's the wrong notation. There should be PI here. So each one of them will have different tuning. And that's, of course, in the general. This is the generic case. So you have pi here and so on. P1, P2, P3, up to Pn. So the individual distributions are not the same. Okay, so let me first talk about continuous stimulus. I'm boring half the audience here because it's something that they all know, but the other half for the sake of them, so the one half can go out. Because this continuous stimulus, this is where I think most of the theoretical work in the past 10 years or maybe more has been focusing on, because it's simple, analytically, and there are well-established results, and the discrete case is relatively not so known and new. Okay, so for what I mean by continuous, I mean now that the theta, so think about the stimulus as not a set of faces, but some feature like contrast, orientation, special frequency, intensity of some stimulus, tone, and so on. So it varies continuously. So there is some continuous space of stimuli, theta, which are there. And in that case, Fish information turns to be the unifying concept for maximum likelihood discrimination estimation and for mutual information and so on. And so Fish information is called information, but actually is statistical notion. And I'll remind you, the basic notion is the following. You have a response R. Again, it's a vector because you have many neurons in general. And you have some way to estimate, to reconstruct the stimulus on the basis of R. So this is theta hat in the estimator, which you build your own estimator, linear, nonlinear, maximum likelihood, whatever. So you have some estimator which takes R and tries to estimate or reconstruct the stimulus. So this is theta hat is the estimated stimulus. So you have theta generated response R, and now you are doing a reconstruction of theta, and you reconstructed value theta hat. So now the question is how far theta hat is from theta. So you have bias, you can have in general bias, namely that even if you average over the noise of R, you still may not be the same as theta. And for this talk, I'll assume that it's unbiased, so the mean will be okay, but you have variance. Because of the fluctuations in R, then theta hat minus average of theta or minus theta will be non-zero. So in general, you have error coming from the bias square and from the variance. And I'll assume bias is zero, and I'll focus on the variance, which is due to the fact that the R is stochastic. Okay, so that's mean square error of the estimator, and now the question is how good you can do in your estimation, how well your estimate can be. And there is a famous Kramer-Rao bound which says that delta, the variance in an unbiased estimator, whatever estimator you use, cannot be bigger. On average, in average sense, cannot be smaller than 1 over j, where j is the Fish information which is given here. So this is j of theta. So in the neighborhood of some stimulus value theta, you take the log probability condition on theta, you take a derivative square and average over r given theta. This average is average of this probability, and you can, by simple integration by part, can show that it's also equal to this. And so this is called Fish information, has a very several nice properties, and the basic one is that it bounds it lower bounds the error that an estimator, the square error that an estimator can have. So J is a property of the distribution, right? And how it depends on theta. Delta will depend on your estimator. One estimator will do poorly, another estimator will do better, but whatever, no matter how clever you are in your choice of an estimator, it cannot do better than 1 over j. That's the Kramer-Rao bound. Okay, in such an example, if you have an independent Gaussian model, so you have neurons which are Gaussianly distributed, so which means that the mean is fi of theta, so this is the tuning of the mean rate. And let's suppose for simplicity that the variance is independent of theta, so just constant CIR, the variance, and in that case Fish information will be like this. So you can see it has a nice property. It's additive in terms of the number of neurons because they are independent, statistically independent. So it's extensive quantity in physics terminology. And it has the notion of signal to noise. So the signal is the derivative of the mean square, how sharply tuned the means with respect to theta, and the noise is the variance CII, so it's sort of signal to noise class. It's a very simple intuitive quantity. This is for Gaussian. You have similar for independent Poisson neurons. It's again have a similar signal to noise, but now the variance in Poisson element, the variance is equal to the mean, so you have Fi of theta down there. Okay, and it's been studied by Sebastian and I and many others in the context of neural tuning curves and so on. Okay, so what about the maximum likelihood and Fischer information? And it turns out that in the case of independent population and large N, one can show that the maximum likelihood estimator, if you try to estimate theta by doing this maximum likelihood procedure, it's first of all unbiased asymptotically, and secondly, it saturates the Kramer-Rao bound. So in general, there is no guarantee that you can actually saturate the bound in a general case. But in the case of a large independent population, in the limit of large n, delta is 1 over j. And as we saw, j itself is linear in n, right? It's additive. So if it's linear in n, it means that the variance is just scaled like 1 over n, or the error 1 over square root of n, which is, of course, naturally what you expect to be. Okay, so you can also talk about discrimination task, not only maximum likelihood estimation. You can look at the maximum likelihood discrimination. Many psychophysics experiments are doing that. They take two stimuli and they measure the error of discriminating between them, and they draw this ROC or related performances, and one can show that again in a large independent population, the error function has a width which is 1 over square root of j. Okay, so Fischer information controls maximum likelihood discrimination, maximum likelihood estimation, so it has a good nice properties. So now, less known, I think, is what is the relation between information in the Shannon sense, or mutual information, and Fischer information. That's a less trivial question. There is a nice result also regarding to that, and this is that the mutual information in the case of large independent population coding for continuous stimulus is the entropy h of theta minus the average, one half the average of log, or plus the average of log of j.
Is this general or for Gaussian?
What? No, that's general. Now, okay, so let me just point out that it looks like somewhat confusing because, you know, j is large, so this is actually plus log j, which j is large, so this term is increasing logarithmically with n. Now, I told you at the beginning that mutual information is the entropy of the stimulus minus something, and now it looks like the entropy of the stimulus plus log n. It looks like it doesn't make sense. Yeah, but still, I mean, but it's... Okay, I'll tell you in a minute, okay, in what sense it's asymptotic. Okay, so you look at it, you say, well, something, somebody made the wrong sign here. Now, the truth matters not, so you have to think more carefully about what is the meaning of information continuous.
So H is differential entropy?
H is differential entropy, that's the point. I mean, so we're talking about continuous stimuli. So H here is the differential entropy, namely what physicists will call entropy, simply. Well, that's this one, okay? But if you want to think in terms of bits, you have to really think about some small discretization of the theta. So then the true entropy of the stimulus will be this plus, the true entropy will be this plus log of 1 over d theta. Okay, and then you have to, so you have to add log of 1 of, you have to add this here, and then you have to subtract it here, so you will get, at the end, you'll get plus log of j of theta times d theta. And this one has to be small, actually, not large. Okay? So this one actually is negative. If you put d theta here, you add log of one over d theta here, okay, and then you put d theta here, then now the denominator is actually small, so the whole thing is actually negative. So this way it obeys the actual limits. But in the case of, and that defines one of the asymptotic regions, if you're talking about discrete stimuli. But anyway, in continuous stimuli, if you use here differential entropy as here, then you get this nice result that the mutual information increases logarithmically with Fisher information. But you already see the difficulty with the mutual information concept. The mutual information... Okay, so this is an example where we can calculate explicitly mutual information analytically. If it's Gaussian, linear, there are some cases we can actually calculate analytically, and then there are two analytical approximations that you can do in general, and we tested it. One is the linear approximation where it's high noise, so it's very little information, and the other one is this asymptotic for large, and just compare how the full curve shows. So this will be the linear approximation, this is the asymptote here, and this is the full curve. This is for a case where you can actually compute it in analytically.
This equation is too general, it's not an approximation.
No, this is approximation where J is large. Right, it's asymptote, yeah, of course. That's again large N approximation. So you think about it the following, you have H of theta, you have log n term, okay, and then you have order one term, okay, and now you have order 1/n, 1/n². So this is true up to order one. The log n and then the order one, this is exact, and then you have order 1/n, 1/n², and so on.
Maybe it should say explicitly, well, this is I between the response of all n neurons and theta.
Yes, you have a population of n neurons.
The whole population.
The whole population of n, but they are statistically independent, and you have a set of theta, a continuous variable theta, and you measure. So this is the mutual information of the ensemble of theta, which is continuously varying, and the population of neurons.
And maybe it's equivalent to saying that if you divide by n, the information per neuron.
No. This is log. This is the point. I does not increase linearly with n. That's the whole point, not the whole point, but the important point that I want to emphasize. This is why mutual information for physicists is sort of quantity which you have to think more like, I don't know, things which go like log n. It's not an extensive quantity. It's not like entropy, free energy.
I think it's dangerous to say in general. You can measure mutual information in many different things. In information theory,
yeah,
it's usually measured like the mutual information between the input and output of the channel.
It is.
And the two things are extensive, and mutual information is very nicely extensive. In this case, theta is finite variable.
Exactly, I agree. Well, I'll talk about other cases.
The general mutual information is not extensive.
In this context, okay.
So it goes like log n.
It increases like log n, which
like
is sort of slowly.
Like chemical potential, which is funny, right?
Log n? Chemical potential?
I mean, like the cost to, like changing the... Like what it costs to free energy to remove a particle.
No, it's extensive, so it's not log n. Changing energy. I mean, if you think about Gaussian kind of statistics, and then the information for Gaussian ensemble is log of the variance, and that's essentially what there is there. Okay. So the variance here is 1/n. Okay. So in the continuous setting, and I agree, this is where theta itself is not extensive. I'll come, if I have time, I'll come to other cases. But I should warn you, right, because Tali and Bialik and others have used, again in the neural context, have used mutual information for a series, time series, for instance, of events. And if there are short range correlations in time, then the input itself is sort of extensive in linear in the epoch of time, and in that sense everything is extensive. But here I'm talking about a stimulus which may be one or two or three dimension theta, but it doesn't grow with n. The stimulus, it's the dimension of the stimulus doesn't grow with n. Okay, so the amount of information that you gain is log n. Okay.
Is it the reason because the total amount of information, the total amount of entropy of the input distribution is finite?
No, that I'm saying. So it cannot increase with log n. Okay. If you think about the discrete case, if you discretize it, there is a ceiling, okay? In any case, it cannot go log. But the question is whether in this region it's linear or log, okay? It could be linear and then saturate, okay? But I'm saying in the region where you are far below saturation, if you think about discreteness, okay, it only goes to as log. Because, I mean, again, because in this region it sort of behaves like essentially Gaussian. If you think about the definition of information in a Gaussian, it's log of the it's log of the variance, okay, so...
The number of digits.
Right, it's not great, but you add one, right, okay, anyway. So, this all, okay, so that's, I mean, it's, in the paper, I think we have a neat derivation of that. So, but this will be for those that are interested in how to derive it. There's a nice functional method of deriving it. In the literature, you'll find derivations which are really ugly. I mean, statisticians don't have a sense of aesthetics. Okay, so it's a nice way to to think how to derive it, but let me skip it. Okay, now I want to connect Fish information to the notion of distance in probability measure in probability space, and there is again well-known relation between them. So think about two distributions, one generated by one stimulus, another by another stimulus on the same space of two neurons or many neurons, and this should be 1/2 here, not 2, so please correct it. And there is a classical, I don't know, well-known result, it's not new, is that, let me introduce Kullback-Leibler distance, or relative entropy. For many of you it's known, but not all of us know it. So let me define it. So DKL, or the Kullback-Leibler distance between two probabilities. So I have probability P and probability Q defined on some random variable X. You can define the relative entropy of Q relative to P is defined as the log the log likelihood of P and Q average over the distribution of P. So you can think about it as the relative entropy of Q relative to the distribution of P. Or another way of thinking about engineering terms is if you think about log of P as the efficient way, the number of bits on average that you will code an event in an efficient way as the log of its frequency of occurrence. So if you code it with the wrong distribution Q, so the number of bits would be log Q, how many extra bits you have to use to encode it. So how much cost in the coding of a variable is you pay by using the wrong distribution. So this would be sort of the same concept. And I think this last interpretation is the one motivation why the Kullback-Leibler distance have been used very often. Okay, so it's very popular.
There's an advantage, it's not symmetrical.
What?
It's not symmetrical.
Right, but I'll come to it. So this is a very popular measure of distance or dissimilarity between two distributions, P and Q, and in our notation, theta 1 and theta 2. So let me just come to it and then I'll discuss what you said. So you can show, so this is 1/2. You can show that for DKL, for two distributions which are continuously varying, in other words, P are continuously varying with theta, and so the Fisher information is essentially the second derivative of the Kullback-Leibler as a function of distance of the parameters theta 1, theta 2. So it's essentially a measure, in that sense, a measure, local measure, of the distance, of the Kullback-Leibler distance, or relative entropy between two distributions.
Is again the limit of...
That's in the limit of theta 1 close to theta 2, right.
And then goes to...
No, that's a general, that's by definition. That's nothing to do with what I said before. That's a general, that's by the definition. It's, you can just, assuming that the P's are continuously varying with theta, in the limit of theta 1 goes to theta 2, you have this is 1/2 should be here. And theta bar is just the mean, I mean, of theta 1, theta 2, doesn't matter when they approach each other. So let me just say for those of you that are interested that J is sort of a very, it's closely related to the concept of susceptibility. If you go back to the definition of J and think about theta is a field. So suppose theta is just a linear field in R. So suppose P is sort of Boltzmann distributed e to the minus some Hamiltonian of R, and theta is linear coupled to R. Then this one, the second derivative, will just be the derivative of the free energy because of the linearity of the field. The second derivative will operate only on the partition function. So this simply will be just a susceptibility with respect to theta. The usual statistical mechanical susceptibility of the system with respect to the field theta. Now, in general, the theta can be a nonlinear operator. On nonlinear field in the Hamiltonian, in that case, this will be a more complicated object. Like it will have the free energy susceptibility. It will be the second derivative of the free energy, but also the nonlinearity, explicit dependence of the Hamiltonian on theta will also enter. So it's a more complicated susceptibility, but it's sort of generalized susceptibility. That's a very sort of well-defined, well-known, well-behaved concept in statistical mechanics in general. Okay. That's J. Okay. So now, that is summary. I'll have to skip it. Properties. Now, let me jump to discrete stimuli. So what the question is, when you have discrete stimuli, you don't have these derivatives in your favor. So you cannot really define local susceptibility with respect to theta, because theta is theta 1, theta 2, theta 3, some number of stimuli, discrete stimuli. So deficient formation at ease cannot be applicable. And the question is, has been for a while around the community that were interested in that, what to do in the case of discrete stimuli. And it's a theoretical question, but it's also sort of practical question. People have generated like data looking, measuring the response of neurons, let's say, for a set of faces in face cells, like Edmund Rawls and others. So how to characterize the tuning properties of the neurons? Is it good or bad? What is a sort of a nice theoretical tool to do that? So you can define mutual information. It's actually better defined in the case of discrete stimuli. But to actually estimate it is numerically it's hard, because it's not extensive, and sort of you have to measure histograms, you have to collect a lot of spikes. You want to have some nice parametric models, like assuming that the neurons are Poisson or some nice model for them, and then be able to efficiently compute some either mutual information or some properties of it. So what people have, what people find in general, if you talk about discrete stimuli and you look at the mutual information, so let me remind you, in the case of if I plot n, the number of neurons, for instance, and mutual information, in the case of continuous, you have some log, well, some linear, and then some log regime here. So if I plot it at log n, okay, it will look linear in log n, and that's deficient information. In the case of discrete, in general, what happens is that you put here the number of neurons, 1, 2, 3, and so on, and you measure the mutual information, and what you get is very quickly some saturation to the bound. Okay, maybe 10 neurons. It depends on how noisy the system is, but you get a very strong saturation here. And then you ask, okay, what can you do? I mean, you can maybe try to approximate, to have some theory for the linear part here. It turns out you can do it, but it's not a good approximator for the rest of the curve. You know that this, you know this bound, because just the log of the stimulus space, but how to characterize, how to extract from such a saturation function to extract something about interesting about the system. So, what happens, how the end dependence here comes about, and and what aspect of it are interest. So I said there is the linear regime here, but it's sort of high noise or low information limit. You can compute it, and you can derive analytical expression for this initial part. But the initial part is interesting only when the system is very noisy. So one neuron has very little information. So you have some linear regime here. Otherwise, you hardly see this. So you don't see anything interesting here. And then after, I don't know, 10 or 20 neurons or whatever, you get this saturation.
It should depend on time, right? If you go to very short time beams.
Right. So if you go to very short time beams, then you are in the limit that each neuron has very little information. So it's very noisy. So you do see this regime. That's what Alessandro Treves and others have been calculating. But if you look at you measure responses over 100 milliseconds or so, then you are already not in this far from this region. The amount of information of each neuron is can be a substantial fraction of a bit, let's say. So it's very poor approximation, the linear part. Again, unless you are in a very noisy limit, where each neuron you measure in a very noisy condition, very poorly tuned, and a very short amount of time. Okay. But other than that, this linear part turns out not to be so useful. And then you are saturating here to this bound. This bound is order one. Again, in my case, in the case what I'm talking about, the stimulus entropy is defined by how many faces you have shown in this experiment or whatever. So it's not extensive in N. N is simply the number of neurons that you look at in order to estimate. So this is fixed, order one. And so the question is, what aspect of these are really interesting? And I'm talking about the simplest case where you have independent neurons, uncorrelated. It's not extensive, it's not log. What is it?
Just a basic question. To get back to the case of continuous stimuli, in practice, I mean, you never have continuous stimuli in the lab.
So that's...
This is where you're interpolating?
Yeah, then you'll step on it. Yeah, I was sort of hinting about what happens. Yeah, when it's discrete and you are approaching this saturation, you already have to discuss this problem.
But if you have no noise, the individual neuron can...
No. I mean, everything is noisy. What do you mean?
But then it's a rubber band, yes, and then you can go to small time limit, and then you have a lot of noise, and you take more and more time to get less and less.
So I'm talking about moderate amount of time, where usually you do the experiment, a few tenths of, 50 milliseconds in, mildly two neurons, and, okay, so I'm not against, looking at the low noise limit. I said, that is well defined, people have done it, and we have reconstructed the results, and we have expression for that, and so on. But I'm saying, I want to go beyond that, okay? What is doing here? Okay, so here is the basic result. Again, there is to actually show it, there's a nice mathematical way of doing it by cell points, mean field, and so on, but the result is essentially is the following. Now let me go back to this picture before we go to the... Is that we have to look at the place where we thought is non-interesting. Turns out to be the interesting region, and this is, I'm looking at these three stimuli, the function of N. This is mutual information. This is the limit, H of the stimulus, which is order one, as I said, it's fixed. So you have this saturation. You have to look at this saturation, and this. So you look at h of theta. You look at the maximum value, which is h of theta minus the mutual information I, and this is exponential in n. This is exponent of minus n to something, and this exponential converges. This exponent here is very interesting quantity, and that's the message. So the exponential saturation to the maximum value, if you think about it, defines as some sort of free energy, which I claim is extensive in N, and that's the object that characterizes nicely the property of the system, and it connects to all the things which I discussed before.
So are you making a strong statement for experimentally?
Well, I'll show how to apply it experimentally. But that's the valid thing. So don't look here. Here, as I said, high noise. You can do some linear here. Here, there is nothing interesting in general. Look at how it approaches this value, And this, if you sort of take the log of that, you uncover, unmask an interesting quantity. Okay. And what is this interesting quantity? So, so it's written here. I is the total entropy of the stimulus. When you have a large number of neurons, okay, so your information will be less than that by small amount. And the small amount is exponent minus some quantity, which I'll define in a minute. So what is the, so it's exponential minus DC, which I'll call denoted chain of distance between two probabilities, one generated by stimulus theta, another one generated by stimulus phi. And since you have some set of stimuli, then you have to look at the max, at the pair which has the minimum distance. Okay, so you have a set of five stimuli. So you have to look at you look at the distances of this stimuli between these stimuli, and you look at the pair which is closest to each other, and this will be this exponential here. Okay, and what is DC? So channel of distance is defined in terms of another set of distances, which is Renault distances, or not Renault, René.
Renji.
What? Renji, the Israeli, but I think René is the right. René, that's I think the right French. René information.
Hungarian.
What?
Hungarian,
right, but the French made him fun, French. Yeah, he's really Hungarian. Okay, so René information is a set of a family of measures d alpha, which are given here. So it's log over the sum over the variable, so the average, but sum of the random variable r. And instead of taking p times log of p, you're taking p to the alpha times p to the one minus alpha times p to the one minus alpha. That's the So that's the extension, and I mean there are various definitions of that, but that's the definition I'll use. So d alpha is the René information, which you can think about it as some sort of distance between theta and phi, between the two distributions, and then you have to maximize with respect to alpha to get what I call the chain of distance, or it's also called chain of information. I call it chain of distance between theta and phi.
What's the range of alpha?
So alpha goes between 0 and 1, so let me define the properties. Before that, so here's the idea. If you look at the, this is an example of a calculation for number of neurons, for efficient, for mutual information divided by the maximum value, so it goes from 0 to 1, and so the idea is that you look at this distance here, I mean this deviation here, and this will behave exponentially with the number of neurons. The convergence exponential, and the exponent DC is given here. Okay, so let me end.
Can I turn back to
what?
So alpha, take maximum of alpha.
Yeah, you maximize over alpha. Okay, I'll show it in a minute exactly what you do. Okay. But you maximize the alpha in general, you also maximize over the pair. So for each pair, so you have a pair of stimuli, each one generates some distribution. Okay, so for each pair, you can sort of calculate the distance between them, this chain of distance between the probabilities that are induced by them. And you look at the pair which is closest to each other. That pair dominates the deviation. Because these ones are easily separated because the distance is further. I mean, is it clear? David, you are... Yeah? I mean, I said David, half of the people here are David, so...
The distance between us is
okay.
But I still don't
I'm not worried about that.
I'm still very unclear how to alpha, I have to say.
Okay, I'll come to alpha. Okay. So, but before that, let me just say that the reason why I think it's a nice concept is because, among other things, it is also a unifying concept, because if you... We also prove that if you do the... I mean, that's maximum likelihood discriminator on the same conditions. The error will be the same exponential with minus DC. So whether you do maximum likelihood discrimination or you do mutual information, essentially you go back to the same concept, which is the chain of distance between pairs of stimuli or between pairs of distributions in your distribution space. Okay, so now let me go to this alpha. So let me first give you a tutorial over distance measures in probabilities. But this is classical, you open books and you find it. Okay, so K, the K of distance is given here. Already Clausius measured, I mean, when I say distance, it doesn't obey the axioms of distance. For instance, K of distance is not symmetric with respect to P and Q. If you flip Q and P and P and Q, then you don't get the same result. It of course doesn't obey the metrics like triangular inequality and so on, but it's a measure, it's a very well known and also useful, extremely useful measure of distance. It is nicely connected to the concept of entropy in statistical mechanics and so on. With an information, the way I define it here, there are various ways of defining them in these factors and so on, but is given here. And there's another, so it's a family for all alpha. Another distance useful, this is the Hellinger distance, which is essentially the naive distance, that you, the Euclidean distance. You take P, the vector of P of X, you take the square root of that, so then this is a vector which has unit length. So each distribution is characterized by unit length vector of positive elements, components, and just do the Euclidean distance between them. Almost, you square root of that. So you take P minus Q square. No, it's exactly the Euclidean distance. It's called Hellinger distance. Okay, it's not. It's, it has a nice geometric interpretation. Just each probability is a unit vector, and just we measure the distance between unit vectors. So it's vectors on a unit sphere in this high dimension, in general. But it's not nice in several aspects. For instance, it's not extensive, right? I mean, it's very. I mean, the dependence. If X is, you know, if P is product of distributions over many elements, so X is R1, R2, and so on, then it will not be. It will not behave nicely, and so on. So these are extensive. These are extensive. This is not okay. Yeah, I'll come to it. Okay, if you take the log there. Okay, so this is the Hellinger distance. It's a very nice geometric interpretation. But okay, chain of distance. Okay, again is in some sense the, do you take the Rene information except for this one over one minus alpha, and you maximize with respect to this parameter alpha. Okay, so I think I hear, okay, so here is an example. You take two Poisson distribution, so just of a one neuron, okay, so this is just number of counts. This is one Poisson distribution with mean 1, and another Poisson distribution with mean 10. You compute d alpha, very simple expression for d alpha for two plus between two Poisson distributions for, you know, two different means. Alpha goes from zero, between 0 and 1, and you can prove that d alpha is positive in the way I define it. It's positive in this region. It's negative outside. There's only one. It's convex, concave, or whatever. I mean, in this, so there's no local maxima and stuff like that. It's that's all you can prove. And chain of distance will be just taking the maximum value, so you maximize with respect to alpha. And to calculate this is for, you know, for two Poissons or two Gaussians, or I mean it's very easy calculation. Okay, so let's look at the form of this. So you see here in general, it's not symmetric with respect to alpha. So here is an example again of two Poissons with the very different rates. If you flip them, okay, then you get the same curve, but flipping alpha to 1 minus alpha. So one property is of this family of function, d alpha of p and q is d of 1 minus alpha of q and p. Okay. So in some sense, this asymmetry in the curve, d alpha, gives you some information about the asymmetry, how of the shapes. In other words, if you have two sort of symmetric-looking shapes that are just displaced from each other, this will be symmetric curve. So d alpha is not simply, you know, is even, you know, if you think about the chain of distance, you just look at it. But if you look at the whole curve, you get more richer information about the nature of the difference between two probabilities. This is why partly the reason why I think it's interesting. So here in general, you see the asymmetry. So if you look at this case where there are more or less closely overlapping, then alpha will be close to alpha must be close to 1/2. And it will look more like a symmetric shape.
So does d alpha have to do with the shape of the distance?
It has to do with the shape. So, yeah, you have to flip. Yeah, if it's a mirror image but displaced, so it doesn't matter how far it displaced, it will give you a symmetric shape. Right. And in general, I'll come to population, and there is another. You can see the symmetry in that. So here, for instance, Gaussian distribution with the same variance, but displaced mean will be symmetric. If the variance are not the same, then it will not be symmetric. But if the variance are the same, but it doesn't matter how far the means are, you'll get this shape with a maximum at 1/2.
The farther apart they are, the higher it goes.
Right. So the farther apart, so the height will increase if they're further apart, of course, relative to the variance. Okay. So if you just think in terms of this number, okay, whether the variance, you know, the shape doesn't really tell you the full information. But if you look at the whole shape, this tells you that these are sort of has a similar shape, just displayed from each other. Okay, there's another interesting property, and this difference between this distance and Kullback-Leibler. This has to do with outliers. So suppose you have a state where so x is the variable. Okay, suppose the probability of x is for some value of x equal to x1, some value is non-zero, but the q probability for that value is zero. So in one probability measure, this has zero probability, this event. Okay, so because of the log which enters, so the Kullback-Leibler distance will diverge. So if there is one event for which in one probability it will be zero, another one will be non-zero, the corresponding Kullback-Leibler distance will diverge. So it's very sensitive to outliers in that sense. Okay, if you look at the alpha, what you find is that it doesn't diverge, it's finite even in this case, but you generate a jump, a discontinuity in alpha equal to zero. And if the reverse happens, you generate discontinuity at the other end. So in general, it is continuous function, except when you have the case where in one probability this event is zero, another one non-zero, you get a jump. Now, if the jump is sufficiently big, you can have a case where just you have a linear, d alpha just linear. So in that case, dc will be just this value, which sort of makes sense if you think more about it. But so that's another another thing to actually appreciate, the fact that you just don't look at dc, but you look at the whole, because if you see the discontinuity or something like that, it tells you again about the nature of the discrepancy between the two distributions. Essentially, the only place where dc will diverge, or the alpha will diverge, will be when the two distributions have zero overlap. If there is no state for which both of them are non-zero, then you can show that the DC will diverge. But other than that, DC will be finite, so it's more well-behaved in terms of outliers. But it does tell you that there are these outliers by, you know, not DC, but the alpha, if you look at discontinuities in the origin.
I think the reason is also to the slope at the side.
Yeah, I'll come. Yeah, you're absolutely right. I think here it is. So I'll summarize here the properties, some of the properties. So first of all, DC is symmetric distance. The reason is that, it should be obvious here, right, that D alpha is not symmetric, but when you flip them, you get the mirror image, so therefore the maximum doesn't change. So DC itself is independent, is symmetric with respect to the exchange of this. Okay. Secondly, in cases where alpha max is 1/2, it's nicely related to Hellinger distance. This is the relation between DC and simply Euclidean distance between the two when it's alpha when alpha max is 1/2. The deviation from 1/2 denotes the amount of symmetry between P and Q. I already mentioned it. And then the last thing is not the last thing, but this point has to do with the relation between this and Kullback-Leibler distance. So you can prove that the slope of d alpha near the origin is the Kullback-Leibler distance. And the slope near 1 is minus the Kullback-Leibler distance for the exchange pair. So these are the two slopes. And this is why you have, in outlier case, you have a discontinuity in D, namely divergence slope, because dk alpha diverges.
And I think, just for the sake of history, I mean, you should mention that this distance was really generated by Chernoff in the 50s.
Well,
the problem of discrimination, I mean, it's the best exponent on the error bound, if you want to say, and actually closely related to another distance which you didn't mention, which is called the Jensen's Chernoff of the. It's actually related to new information again. So the whole thing of, maybe I'll say something about it on my talk.
Okay. Please, come to, I mean, I think it was clear that if I said Chernoff distance and Aston-Poninsky distance, that what I meant. I think it's even earlier than 50s, but any case, yeah, of course, this is Chernoff distance is because Chernoff had it, and...
The context, which actually is directly related, I think, to the motivation is for this extensive quantity.
Okay. It's not okay, but I mean, all these properties are, most of them are things that you can find in the books or in articles. It's not something which I mean this property and you know, and many others. Yeah, it's something which I'm introducing here in this context. We didn't find the mutual information result, you know, but anyway, that's nothing is new. If this happens, makes, you know, anybody satisfied, I mean, that's fine. I just wanted to point out that I think this is an interesting quantity. Okay, and the last one is that this chain of distance, in cases where you can vary parameter like theta and make Q and P close to each other, then again you can prove that alpha is 1/2 and it just goes to the Kolbe-Plagge distance. Okay, so this is an example of, so I'm almost done, and then I say a few words about extension of that. This is like an example of how you do it. I think that's what we, example that we've done for neurons. So you have, I mean, so again, I want to, I'm not sure I've said it, but I want to emphasize that in case of the non-interacting, a non-correlated population, then d alpha is just additive, is that additive, so d alpha is extensive. Dc itself is not extensive because you have this global maximization of the alpha, so it's not simply, I mean, it's not strictly extensive, but it usually, it has well-behaved limits, so you can think about dc also as extensive, if there is a well-behaved limit for the maximization of alpha. But in any case, so what you do is you take individual neurons, you draw this alpha, but you sum them, and then you maximize. So in other words, you don't maximize alpha each individually, you take the sum of this, and then you maximize it, because each individual one can give you very different alpha. So you have to maximize over alpha only when you sum them. I think that's sort of operational thing. And in general, what you find...
I'm still at a loss. I mean, X is DC to go back to your curve, to the asymptote. Are you going to connect this back?
Wait, which X?
You know, the minus N.
This?
Yeah.
No, this was time something. This is DC. And it's linear in N.
Okay.
And what I'm showing here, what I'm talking now about is this. Okay, so if I have a population of neurons responding, I have set of stimuli, I put in front of the, you know, an animal, I record simultaneously set of neurons, and now I want to characterize their behavior, then forget about mutual information, maximum microdiscriminant, forget about all this. I'm telling you what is the measure that you characterize the efficiency of the coding. Okay.
So the other thing I'm just a little confused. You make up your stimuli, and there'll be some pair of stimuli that are very close. So this.
You do it for all pairs of stimuli.
Okay, but there's going to be one pair that's particularly close.
Yeah.
So that's going to dominate, right? You calculate.
It dominate this divide.
So there's going to be a self-consistency. Is that the idea? There's a self-consistency because I can calculate what this looks like because I look at all the pairs, and one pair is particularly close.
Yeah, I mean, there's no self-consistency. Just take the one which is particular, which is, there is no iteration. Just you have a well-defined measure. It's a pairwise measure. D alpha is or D alpha or DC is a measure between two stimuli or two probabilities. And just measure them, and then you take the.
Okay, but
there's no bootstrapping here.
Okay, No, but I have my set of stimuli, and my set of stimuli.
You have responses. You have responses. You have some parametric, let's say, Poisson distribution for response of a neuron for this set of stimuli. Okay. Okay. Now you have 5 stimuli, 10 stimuli.
No, the problem is it all depends on just one pair of stimuli. So all of the rest of the stimuli somehow are not important. That's, I think, intuitively not very clear why.
No. I mean, in acid, okay, mathematically,
yeah.
This exponential, I mean, you think about the set of exponents. So you can think about it as sum of the all pairs e to the minus dc of, you know, stimuli and phi and sum of them. Okay? But because this is exponentially fast, then it will dominate. Then, you know, the smallest exponent will dominate. What can I do? You know, I mean, you think about it as this way. I mean, that's a more convenient way of thinking about it, right? You take all pairs of stimuli and you sum these. Okay? But I'm saying because this is exponentially large with n, this c is proportional to n. So obviously, you know, the lowest eigenvalue or the smallest one will dominate, and the smallest one will be the one, the closest pair.
So this will be extremely sensitive to the set of stimuli you choose.
No, this C will not change. This C is smooth.
This measure.
No, but I'm saying forget about this measure. I'm saying think about this. This is a smooth thing. I mean, forget.
Yeah.
And this is the motivation. I mean, forget about mutual information. Forget about maximum likelihood. Just I'll give you a
this
measure.
Is for a discrete set of stimuli.
Yeah.
I mean that if you take out one stimulus, you will get very different behavior.
For what? For this?
For this curve.
For mutual information. Yeah. But that's a fact of life, and there's nothing.
Right.
Nothing that can be done about.
So it's very sensitive to a precise set of stimuli.
That's a fact. That's not my fault. That's reality. I'm just saying.
Yeah.
There is nothing to do about it. But what I'm saying is, rather than thinking about this, think about, you know, about your set of stimuli. Think about a set of stimuli, okay, and think about this as sort of bonds or measures of dissimilarity between them, and this set is sort of characterizing your responses.
So sorry, just to go back, DC depends on nothing to do with the response and only on the set of stimuli.
No, DC is calculated by these distributions which are the responses. I mean, let me go back to the alpha.
I got it.
Of course, Where is the definition? Here. Okay? You take the alpha, this Px or Pr of given theta, this is your tuning or whatever, the probabilities of responding, you know, R given theta. And this is Q will be P of R given phi. These are the responses, right? Here is a practical example for an experimentalist. You have a set of, I don't know how many neurons, 1, 2, 3, 10 neurons, let's say, and you model them by Poisson, and you measure the firing rate for, let's say, 2 directions. I think this is the example which I'm bringing here. So, here an example, okay? So you have this canonical Georgopoulos example, experiment, you measure motor cortex responses of neurons, simultaneous responses of neurons, to one of six directions. Now, there are 2 ways to think about it. One way to think about it is to say, well, this motor cortex area is actually coding for the direction of our movement, which is a continuous variable, and that's what we have done all the time. You know, that we have thought about in terms of cosine tuning, direction for the responses of neurons and so on. You can also argue, and people have argued from the beginning, that this monkey is overtrained, very overtrained, to this particular set of directions. He was sitting there and got juice only when, you know, so every morning came and these movements for these targets. So perhaps the neuronal area was rewired or was fine-tuned to this particular direction. So you want to sort of choose the alternative view. So let's assume that the system is really now, after all this overtraining, is coding these six directions. How now you will characterize the quality of the response and eventually connect the two approaches, but we didn't connect yet. It just so I'm showing you how to actually apply it. Okay, so you're doing this experiment. What do you do? So you measure for some period of time around the movement onset, let's say 400 milliseconds or 200 milliseconds, whatever you take here, the window of time, and you collect the number of spikes for, this is single neuron for these six directions, and simultaneously you have other neurons, and for simplicity, let's say you draw correlations and you assume that each one has Poisson statistics. So here it is a parametric Poisson model, so for -6 degrees, this one neuron has this, it looks like Gaussian, but anyway, do Poisson distribution, no, this is actually Poisson.
Where is the fact that that you record simultaneously?
No, this is that, wait, this is just one neuron. You have to be patient, this is an experiment, it's not easy. Okay, so one neuron I record, I collect statistics for the response of that neuron, the number of spikes with that window for this direction of movement. And let's say I model it by some, well, not Gaussian, let's say Poisson distribution, okay? So Poisson with some given mean. The same neuron, PR, so this will be PR1, neuron R, with respect to this theta. This will be PR1, neuron 1, with respect to this theta, and so on. So now you have PR of that neuron, PR1, for this set of stimuli, discrete stimuli, okay? One neuron. Now you do it for the other neuron, which is simultaneously recorded. You collect the same statistics, okay? You assume, I mean, I'm ignoring correlations, okay? So the other neuron will have different, you know, you'll have this.
But you're averaging here over many trials.
It is, I'm calculating distribution.
So then I just don't understand what has to be.
You don't need to sound.
Well, because now the measure that I'm talking about is given a vector of responses, R1, R2, R3, R4, simultaneously recorded, okay, how well I can extract which direction the monkey has moved.
The two
different things. This is the observation and my model of their statistics.
Right, but you would think that I could record in location 1, then location 2, then location 3, then location 4 in a serial experiment.
Yes.
And then do another experiment where I put a wire back in location 1, 2, 3, 4.
Let me just answer you. Let me answer you. The creating of the model, if you assume they are independent, you can measure them not simultaneously. For the building up of the model of the responses, because if you assume that they are weakly correlated or uncorrelated, you just go to a neuron 1 and you measure its Poisson. You do this experiment for neuron 1 many times, okay? Now you go to neuron 2 many times, whatever, and you build this. So this is for the building of the model of the statistics.
Yeah.
But what the question that you ask, namely, this DC or whatever measure is if you observe simultaneously responses R1, R2 and neurons, okay, how much information it gives you about the direction of movement.
Okay.
But the building up of the model, if you assume they're uncorrelated, you can do it for each neuron separately. Yeah.
I think that Misha raised actually a very bothering concern. So if there is a distribution P of theta which is continuous of all possible stimuli,
it's discrete. I'm not talking about continuous.
So the quantity DC that you emphasized,
yeah,
really is more describing more than the discrete set of stimuli than the response of the system. It's really more stimuli dependent than system dependent. That's
If
I completely change the distribution now, let's say that I take this six.
Let me finish and then open for discussion, because I think this is any measure. Fish information it depends on the stimuli.
No, this information has an average. And
it's also an average. This is average of all pairs.
On the closest points in
your Wait. I'm emphasizing, and I want to emphasize again. It's not my fault that the mutual information will be sensitive to the closest one. I mean, sensitive to the extent that this eigenvalue, in the asymptotic sense, will be dominated by the closest pair, okay? And I don't have time, I'll discuss what happens if you have many stimuli, and then it's different. Okay, but wait, let me finish one thing, and then, okay. But what I'm saying, what?
I think this is an important point that has to be clarified.
Well, there's so many important points. Let me just, okay. What I'm saying,
I don't understand you. DC is not sensitive.
But what I'm saying is forget about mutual information. I'm giving you as a motivation. I'm saying DC is well-defined quantity, which is for pair, so it's not exponential, it's extensive, right? So it's smoothly varying with this distance as a pair of stimuli. And I think it's a very nice characterization of this sort of dissimilarity, like any other thing. And I don't think this is bad. This is, I think, a very nice quantity to look at.
It's an excellent measure of how well you can separate between groups.
That's fine. I mean, okay, so that's you. That's what I'm saying all the time, okay?
It's not a good characterization of the neural system for natural stimuli. In this case, or whether natural movement or whatever.
Why not?
Because it is too sensitive to the particular.
DC is not sensitive. I'm sorry, it's not sensitive, DC. Okay, I'm sorry. Let's go ahead and discuss it. Klaus has to talk now. No, I'm serious. At 10:30, right? I mean, it's not. No, I don't want to. I mean, I can go on. I mean, I think this is wrong. When you exponentiate things, then small differences become large differences. But when you talk about DC, it's a nice, smooth thing, and it's not sensitive. I'm sorry. The meaning of it in terms of I is sensitive. But anyway, okay. Don't.
Go back. I mean, this is finally the meat, how to use this.
Okay, so here I'm giving. Okay, so this one neuron, you do it for another neuron, you get this, Poisson model for the second neuron, for the different directions, and so on. And essentially, if you're using Poisson model, you just measure the mean, and you get the whole thing. So you get the mean responses of the mean number of spikes for this neuron, for that neuron. I'm sorry, for the same neuron, for the six directions. You take another neuron, you do it for the same story, and so on. And now what you do, and now you are sort of correct. So this now you build up this d alpha. So for instance, you want to know how the two stimuli, two directions, 0 and 45, what is the distance between them, given some number of neurons, okay? So you just you calculate d alpha. It's a very simple expression for two Poissons. Yeah, Poisson, for each neuron, now you have two distributions. One generated by 0, so, and the other one by 45.
These are for like 10 different neurons.
Well, 15 or whatever. So each one of them is for one neuron. You just take one neuron. One neuron now has two Poisson distributions associated with it. One is the distribution associated with 0 degrees movement, and one with 45 degrees movement. Okay? And you just calculate this simple expression, P, it's a very simple expression for D alpha for two Poisson distribution for the same neuron. And now you sum them. So you see, some neurons will be very asymmetric, some will be more asymmetric to the other side, and so on, and discuss this. You sum them, you get a nice curve here, d alpha, and that's what I think is a nice characterization of the system, maximum, alpha maximum, and so on. Is it clear? No.
Yeah, and I mean, is it...
This will be then the distance. D alpha will be the family of distance, and DC here will be the distance between, movement 0 degrees and movement 45 degrees as determined by an ensemble of 15 neurons that you measure.
And then I have...
For another pair of directions, okay?
You do for all pairs of directions.
Yeah, you do it separately for all pairs of directions.
This is a real example.
What? This is a real example. This is from data.
Okay, so D alpha actually for 15 neurons is so big.
Well, it's not so big. I mean, because now we're talking about log and talking about bits, right? So, well, 6, log of 6, I don't know. I mean, it's not that terribly big. You see most of the neurons. Okay, so you start to see most the inhomogeneity. Most of the neurons are really bad, badly tuned, right? The contribution is small, and then there are some big ones. So, again, this I'm showing it an example of how to use it in practice. We haven't yet analyzed it in detail because... But you already, I mean, this is something that you see also with other measures like Fisher information or mutual information, other measures that many neurons are very poorly tuned and they contribute very little to the whole story. And there are some, you start to hear some decent contribution of neurons which contribute to that. Okay, this is for 81 neurons. In motor cortex, for again a pair of distances.
Is it coincidence that the sum is very symmetrical.
No, it's not. I mean, that's what we find here. It is that's what we find as a function of n. We find that it's very close to the population is very close to 1/2, actually. So this is again another example as a function of n, and this is sort of the statistical error. But it's sort of you see it's becoming relatively close to 1/2. That's an experimental. It is symmetric. DC is symmetric because D alpha is just a chain of 1 minus alpha and alpha, so the maximum is symmetric. So the function is not. So this was D alpha was if I go back to here.
Right.
Okay. So I forgot which one I chose. You know, one of them. These curves are not symmetric. If I flip, it will go to this side.
Okay, so for each curve, you
always did 0.5. Yeah, I forgot. You know, one of them was, it wasn't symmetric, right? But the maximum here will be symmetric. So DC itself will be symmetric. This is for that number of cells. So this is a function of number of cells. Again, this is a fake data because they're not simultaneously recorded, but I'm assuming, again, we discussed it, that they're statistically independent, I build the statistic and so on. And this is as a function, distances relative to 0 degrees as a function of number of cells. And one question was actually, so to see how, I mean, so you see kind of see big jumps as certain cells, come into play. They really give you big increases in the.
That's right. This is between 0 and.
Between 0 and 45 degrees, 90 degrees, 180 degrees, and so on. It's interesting that this is not the biggest. You'd expect, 180 degrees will be most separated.
Well,
it's not.
45 to 315 are also not the same.
Right. So this asymmetry, which we don't know yet whether. Again, this is. That's a demo of how you apply it. I don't want to make scientific claims. We don't know whether this asymmetry is a real anisotropy in the system or not.
But as you point out, I mean, by looking at this data, it seems that then by the time you got in your simulation, by the time you got the 55 cells, you found like the magic cell for 315 or something.
No, we also played with averaging. No, we sampled randomly. You get this picture more or less. I mean, it's smoother than this, but.
What is the underlying model of the population?
Poisson, independent Poisson.
So can you do psychophysics and figure out how many cells the monkey is actually using now? I mean, because the more cells the monkey can use, the better it can describe.
Yeah, you could do the psychophysics. I mean, compare psychophysic accuracy with the number of cells.
And how many cells for, the actually
yeah, I mean, we haven't done it yet because, I mean, again, psychophysics. Okay, I would do the psychophysics on the same monkey for this given directions and to see, right? Because otherwise you think about more general continuous directions and so on. People have claimed in other contexts that you need, for 400, 500 neurons in this area to actually get the accuracy. But that's for sort of a more continuous setting. There is no psychophysics, as far as I know, for this particular set of data.
I understand the jumps, but I don't understand this bow. Shouldn't DC be an extensive quantity of the number of cells? It should be on average.
Well, it should be asymptotically should be extensive, but the point is no, because DC is more correctly saying is additive, is extensive in the sense that you sum over all I, okay. Right? So in the large n limit, you can think about it as some average over distributions times n. But since not all the nodes are identical, right? Then if all the nodes will be identically tuned, then it will be just from the beginning n times something.
Yes.
But because they don't have the same tuning.
The letter neurons just have more information, right?
Well, if you look at the slope. Right, but we also resampled the neurons. I mean, it's heavier calculation. You just draw them, and then it smooths this. But then by definition, if you resample the neurons and you average each point, then by definition it's linear, right? Because you just average over all the differences between them. Then you get straight linear curve. So, but sort of these differences are not washed out. This one is, of course, becoming straight linear if you do that.
But if this had been a real experiment and you did find that this did not scale like n, I mean, that would be disturbing, right? Because I would tell you there are sort of special neurons. There are neurons that carry most of the information about that stimulus.
Yeah, the deviation with the N will have to do with how inhomogeneous the system is, exactly. How heterogeneous is. If most of the neurons are sort of bad, only a few neurons are good, then it will not look like right. Exactly, you're right.
Because then that bears on this deeper issue, because the assumption is always that you could just average in neuroscience, and you're saying that this is going to reveal, I mean, you can't always average.
Yeah, but I'm saying, that depends. Yeah, that's more or less independent of this particular measure. I'm discussing this context, but you can use other measures and reveal the enormous heterogeneity in the quality of tuning that you have in this system and others. And there is an experimental issue, which is a whole other discussion, which neurons are really recorded. There are the PN neurons, there are five neurons which have direct output to the spinal cord. They may be better tuned. Maybe those are the neurons with high DC and so on. So there is very important questions about the identity of the neurons that look like better tuned, much farther better tuned than others. There's also difference in the labs. Like, must say, two nearby labs generate very different numbers here, and it was quite puzzling to us. It turns out that one lab make a special effort to go deeper, maybe more sampling layer five neurons, and other labs just went randomly along layers, and the results were like order of magnitude. I won't say which lab is which, but one lab got here numbers like 80 or more, and relative to 10 or so on, so a factor of 5 or 10 larger. And we said, the same monkey, how can it be? Turns out that among other things, one lab, as I said, was careful to look at a deeper layer, and that's
an interesting observation. If this is the reason, this is very interesting observation.
I know. I mean, that's so far just anecdotal. I asked the guy, what? How can it be? But we have to go back. I said, this is just to show you how we apply to data. I don't want to make strong claims because it needs further.
I think, this is real data.
Yes, it's real data. What can I do?
So you said that the simulation, that this is a fake data based on
personal. No. It's real.
Real data. Not simultaneously.
It's real data. Part of them was simultaneously recorded. We don't have, as you know, in our lab, 80 neurons simultaneously recorded. And
so it's resampling of real data. It's independent.
No. Okay. As I said before, if I ignore correlations, then the building, then characterizing the distribution doesn't matter whether it's simultaneously recorded or not. Okay, so here ignoring correlations, so whether it's simultaneously recorded or not is not important. You just have 80 neurons, which you characterize their probability distributions for different this, and then you measure DC. Okay, now what I'm saying, DC, the meaning of it has to do with looking at an example of the neurons simultaneously. Otherwise, that's the meaning. If you look at fission formation, all this, when I talk about N neurons, we are really talking about observing simultaneously N neurons. This has not been done, but that doesn't matter. Because I'm not. DC will tell you if you had observed, or if the homunculus in the brain will look at those neurons simultaneously, how good it will do. Okay? Whether you would have done simultaneous measurement or not, it doesn't matter. It really doesn't matter because if you assume that they're uncorrelated. So it's real. Okay?
Different neurons not measured
simultaneously. Some of them measure simultaneously, some of them not.
The same monkey,
the same experiment.
The same stimuli.
Yeah, the same set of stimuli, exactly. Some of them were measured the same. Some of them were measured simultaneously, some of them not. The whole issue of correlations, as I said, it's an entirely another story, and I'm not.
But you're saying that after you give that story, that it's not an important issue.
It's a very important issue. Well, it's important issue whether for the actual for sets of data whether it's important or not. It's still question because we don't have good data to characterize the correlation. We know more or less about the order of magnitude, but you need more than that in order to characterize the effect on the quality of code. You need to know how they're tuned, how the correlations themselves vary with the stimulus. And that has, unfortunately, the data is not good. We've worked a lot of it over the last 2 years, and the data is poor about that. we don't have enough neurons, and there is non-stationarity involved, and so that's a whole discussion about how to actually estimate that. But potentially it's very important. We have cases we can show in models, cases where all the information is in correlation, essentially not in the. And then the issue is how to extract information from correlations and so on. So that's, I think, a very important topic. But unfortunately, our attempt, I would say even heroic attempt, to extract decent estimate from data, from available data, came with only very partial success. You need to have much more cleaner data on that. Okay. That's the end. Okay, that's the end. Let me, if I have 5 more minutes. Okay, address just very briefly the following. I mean, it has to do with some of the questions that have been raised here, and that's the following question. Suppose now we are talking about discrete set of stimuli, but many. Until now I said that there's some finite number of stimuli, and I have many neurons, and then there's exponential convergence, then DC, and so on. And I said can I erase this? David, can I erase this?
You can erase it. Don't erase it.
No. Oh, what do I do here?
Can
you
turn on the board?
Can I? Well, maybe cover this or something. So, what happens when n is large? Okay, so now the question is, when n is large, so both the number of stimuli is large, and also the number of neurons is large. Now, what's happening in this case? Now, so the question, one question is to address it is, what is the relation between n and m, where interesting thing happens? M is large, you know, number of stimuli is large, number of neurons is large, but how they are related? Power law or something? So, like Tali mentioned before, that both of them are extensive. But actually, it turns out that I think nothing interesting happens until M is actually exponentially large relative to M. And that's actually takes us to the Shannon theory limit. So, in other words, the Shannon theory essentially says that if I think about, in this context, about M, which is exponentially large in the number of neurons that I'm... So think about M stimuli as M messages that I want to send through the system. And the system has N channels, and the channels are the neurons, the different neurons. So we can transfer the whole thing to the setting of Shannon capacity theorem. And the capacity theorem says that when the number, the actual, you know, things that... I mean, this stupid saturation starts to fail... And it's not when M is extensive in N, but actually M is exponential in N. Okay, and again, because of the log relation between the number of bits that you, and so on. So let's think about this case. Well, so now we are just jumping to an entire different setting where you have exponentially large number of stimuli, exponential in the number of neurons, okay? And what happens in this case? So when M... When R is small, when R is zero, when M was finite, and so on, we said that, you know, when in the large N limit, essentially all the information asymptotically converges to the maximum information. There is no error probability. Okay. Now Shannon theorem says, so let me plot here R. Okay, and this is zero, and let me plot then the probability of making errors, some average sense. Let me plot the log of that divided by n and take a minus sign. Okay, so let me call this, I don't know, free energy or something, g. F is a nice free energy. Okay, so here is f. And what I discussed now is what happens when r equal to zero. You can think about it, when m was finite. When r equal to zero, we had this chain of distance actually here, okay, and it was scaled with n asymptotically. So this f was sort of chain of distance for the smallest pair. So this is this value here. So if I have m messages, so this will be the channel of distance between the closest pair. So this is this value, right? I mean, is it clear? Misha, are you with me? Okay? So now you can ask, okay, when it starts deviate? So it turns out that this exponentially small error, okay, it's still exponentially small error, even when, as I said, when it's, let's say, m is proportional to n or some power, until you go to this exponential relation. And Shannon theorem says that actually f, this what's called error exponent, is finite until the capacity limit, which is here, Rc. So f sort of goes to zero here, the Shannon theorem. So actually this exponential saturation has a long wait, I mean, to go before it breaks down. It's not something you can say, well, you know, but you have many number of stimuli. Yeah, but you have to have very many number of stimuli compared to the number of neurons to actually start to see the Shannon capacity things. Okay. Now, incidentally, but the case of Bilbialik and perhaps Taliu has been working, I mean, n was small, and the one neuron, the famous fly neuron, and so on. So, but I'm talking, if you look at 50 neurons and so on, then m has is a large number that you're really talking about for signal capacity. Okay, so now the question is how to actually, from the point of view of the theory that I discussed, how you actually can see actually that at some point you go to zero. I mean, if you just take f to be the DC between this weakest, the closest pair of stimuli, this DC doesn't vanish here. Okay. So it vanishes way above this. So this is not, so something in the theory has to break down. Now, of course, the theory was assuming m is finite now. Why it should apply to m, which is exponential in n? Nevertheless, as I said, the error is still exponentially small. So what happens between zero and Rc to get the Shannon theorem? And this is something which Dan Lee and I have been thinking in the last year. And it has some theoretical motivation to look at it, but it's also, I think, interesting question about neural code, because in some cases people claim, Bilbialik perhaps the primary claimer for that, is that neural codes are very efficient, are close to Shannon limit. And what I was showing you, these poor 80 neurons coding, you know, finite number of stimuli, it was very, very, very far from Shannon theorem and limit. And actually, I think for good reasons, because if you look at the tuning curves, to get a Shannon coding, you have to really have some random tuning and so on. So we wanted to know how to connect between this broad, smooth tuning and actually Shannon limit. Okay, but going back to the theory. So how to actually go to here? Okay, so the answer is, and that's again something which some mathematicians knew in the 60s or 70s, Shannon and Gallagher and others, and we're trying to sort of understand it from perspective of statistical mechanics, but many of the results are known, and this is the following. There are actually two transitions, interesting transitions, between zero and Shannon capacity limit. So let's call it R1, R2. And the two transitions are the following. Okay, so suppose I have this m messages and I want to encode the neurons. So you can sort of think naively about approximating the error by looking at this, theta and phi, two pairs of messages which are not equal to each other, and sort of the probability of confusing between them. The kind of setting that I used here. And this, as I said, each one of them is e to the minus dc of this, sorry, I was confusing them, dc, theta, and phi, okay? So you can take this as a starting point for approximating the total error of this channel. And so first question is, can you approximate this by the smallest pair? Okay, so can you say, well, it's dominated, as I said before, by the pair of messages which are most confusing, which has the minimum DC. And that's what I said happens when M is finite. It turns out that it's true when M is exponential in R up to R1. Okay? And there is a transition here where it pays to look at the at pairs of messages which are not so close to each other, but there are many more of them. And so there are two exponentials which are competing each other, and this transition happens to be exactly analogous to a random energy transition. Think about DC as sort of random energies and this set of random energies, and we know that when when some temperature, which is the analog of R, goes down, you are frozen into the slowest energy state, which is the minimum DC. So that's what happens here. It's sort of frozen in the language of that is a frozen phase, where you are dominated everything by the lowest, the lowest energy, which is the smallest DC, and then so this will be just the same theory as I had before, extending now to enormous number of M's, to exponentially large number of M's, up to R. So up to this theory is just applicable. Here you have this melting transition where the typical kind of DC, you have to compete this exponent with this exponent, like a random energy model, and you have, and so these curves are not continuous. I mean, these are two branches, and there is a phase transition here. Okay. So that's all nice. Now, you still, if you continue this, you don't get Shannon limit. And something else happens. It turns out that there is a correlation transition, which is that here, we're assuming that you can take sort of the probability of error. By the way, this transition you can see only if you take the log of the probability, not the average probability. The average probability, as everybody in statistics or in information theory does, is like the anneal theory. And you don't see this transition. Of course, we know the anneal theory, it just goes down to, there is no transition if you do the anneal theory. You have to do the Quench theory, the typical error, not the average error, to actually uncover this transition. Okay. But actually have interest in information theory about typical error versus average error. Okay, this is this transition. Turns out now, you can also say, the probability of error is not necessarily the sum of pairwise confusions, because suppose you're making an error with several, you send one message, you get some noisy version of it, or noisy response, noisy output of the channel. Now at the same time, you can confuse it because of the noise of the channel. It can be closer to messages 1, 2, 3. And not to the real metadata. In other words, you make at the same time error with several one of them. So you overcount the error by assuming just a pairwise error, sum of pairwise error. So you have, when R is sufficiently large, you start to make correlated errors. So this pairwise, so going back to the picture, I said, well, there are a set of stimuli, and you characterize it by the pairwise distances, or the pairwise. This breaks down. There are too many of them. You start to make correlated errors with several of them. So when this breaks down, you get this transition R2, and you get a higher. So this is the overcounting, and therefore you get. So you get a series. So this is again overcounting, and then you get this. And then if you, in this region, you have to take a more global way of calculating P, not by this breaks down, and then you take this branch, you actually reach the Shannon transition. So near here, near Shannon transition, the concept of looking at pairs, okay, is completely breaks down, okay, in order to characterize the performance of the whole system. From here, it is okay, here you characterize by the sort of worst case, the lowest energy. Here you look sort of more average DC. So that's sort of the whole picture on one thing, how to connect population coding for small number of stimuli up to the Shannon limit. This last part is not here. We have still problems, questions about replica symmetry breaking and stuff like that to calculate that. But okay, let me finish here. Thank you.
I'm Yeah. I haven't had a chance to think about this so much, but I think there's something that I'm not quite understanding. And I think that, if I understand correctly, I think that your picture of how the brain is working and my picture wouldn't match up.
Okay.
And
so I'm still your fun brain.
And what I would think is, and it may be the different parts of the brain that are in different ways. See, I would think that the brain would know already the tuning curves for every cell.
That's what I was also thinking.
And so
I was using that. No, actually I was using that.
And so what it would be able to do is it would be able to average across cells making use of the information about the tuning curves, and then
so we are completely in agreement, because because all the measures that I was talking about, whether it's fission formation, continuous measure, or this, all of them were actually heavily using the proper, what I assumed was the proper distribution of each neuron for the set of stimuli. Okay, I showed that I, construct this Poisson distribution and so on. What you are talking about is something else. You are asking, okay, how do I extract this information? Yes. I had to do clever averaging. Now, I didn't talk about that.
Okay.
I talked about potentials. I said how much information there is in the system.
Okay.
Now, there is, an interesting question. Okay, fine. There is so much information. How do you get it out? So you had to do some clever averaging, linear, nonlinear, winner-take-all, maximum likelihood kind of decision, whatever. That's a matter of how you read out. And that's, again, another talk. But it's but actually, even for those measures that I've been talking about here, those measures rely on the statistics, or the sort of, they assume that you know the statistics.
Yes.
And so in that sense, it's the same.
Yeah, because if you think about color vision, for example, we can discriminate wavelengths very finely.
Yeah.
Yet the tuning curves are extremely overlapping.
This will be also here. I mean, the tuning curve here of individual neurons are extremely overlapping.
Yeah.
But by the time you look at population of cells, you get the hyperacuity. Yeah, you also get here. Because, as I showed, I mean, many, many single neurons are poor, and even if all the neurons will be relatively broadly overlapping, by the time you look at hundreds of them, you get a very nice separation.
Yeah, I think what was confusing was your example at the end. You just took the cells without knowing anything about them.
No, I was saying, from experiment, I build their tuning curves.
Yes.
So I know, I just measure many times, like the brain supposedly is done over the lifetime of the animal, or maybe, okay, and I'm collecting statistics, and I'm characterizing each neuron by its statistical properties of how it responds to the set of stimuli. And I'm using that to measure how good I'll do if you give me one observation, knowing the statistical properties, okay, how one observation, how much information it will give me on the stimulus. So the way I built these various information measures, I was using the statistics. What they are telling me is about a single observation. Assuming I know the statistics, and I am able to extract the information, how much information I can extract from a single observation on average. I was not telling you, and you're absolutely right, how to extract information. That part I've not talked about. How do I actually can really do the information extraction, the readout. How do I average, putting more weights on more, finely tuned neurons, less weight there, and so on. That I've not talked about. Yeah.
Do you have any idea what is the ratio between R1 and R2?
Yeah, we have expression for that. I mean, it depends on... No, it's all the one. It's all the one. Yeah, it's all the one.
So
R is all the one. I know, but it depends on the noise of the channel and so on.
So this curve looks like a good characterization of the system itself.
And I'm saying this curve is identical to what I was talking about.
This curve, the function of the number of curves.
I was talking about r equal to zero. Okay, I mean, the function of r is very simple. I mean, just minus r. There is no,
right.
Nothing. I mean, but I'm saying this curve is, what should I say? Okay, I forgot which factor enters it, but this curve is simply related to the DC of the weakest bond. And the point is the weakest bond changes as a function of R. The dependence on R is coming from the fact that the more stimuli you have, okay, so this is this curve. This curve is exactly what I was talking about, okay? This curve is very similar, except that you average over all pairs, and you can calculate the dominant. So the dominant contribution is not from the weakest, from the smallest one, from something in between the typical and the smallest one. It has to do with R. So this is this curve. It's still dominated by pairwise, but it's not the weakest bond, so to speak, not the closest, but intermediate. This pair is already global. I mean, this curve is already global. It's a different story. You don't talk about pairwise errors.